Hello and welcome to our Krauscast webinar series. My name is Elisa Lamel and I am the legal content specialist here at Kraus Financial Services. Today's topic is how to use the Medicaid desk reference, hosted by our Vice President of Sales and Marketing, Thomas Kraus. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Tom, I'll turn it over to you.
I thank you, Elisa, and I want to thank everybody for joining us today. This is the first webinar of 2023. Hope everyone had an enjoyable holiday season. This webinar is something I put together a number of years back. It's a refresher webinar. It kind of covers a lot of the foundational information that you really need when you're doing this planning. It's something that I developed when I was kind of going through the process of really understanding the planning at an in-depth level. It kept coming across certain terms and terminology that was used, and it all seemed pretty foreign to me at the time. But once, you know, I spent some time with it and really had a deeper understanding, it all kind of came together. You know, I equate Medicaid planning and crisis planning kind of to like snowboarding, where the initial learning curve is very steep. So to learn your curves and your carves and to be able to make it down the hill, it's very, very difficult initially because of all that terminology and nuance. So it's once you get past that and you really understand the foundational pieces, kind of like understanding the foundational carving on the snowboard, then you're able to make it down the hill at a reasonable rate without falling on your face. But it is a very difficult, like I said, initial learning curve. So today's presentation is really to clarify some of those foundational terms and terminology that you'll run across. And the desk reference, it really coincides with some of the numbers that have just changed as of January, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the presentation. But again, these are the foundational terms and numbers that you really need to know and you need to understand in order to do this planning effectively. So a little bit about us before we jump into the presentation. For those of you who are not aware or maybe are working with us for the first time, Kraus Financial Services, we were established a number of years ago. We've been in the crisis planning, Medicaid planning space for over 30 years. We developed some of our flagship product known as a Medicaid compliant annuity. And we really worked with attorneys across the country to function as their back office for crisis Medicaid planning, utilizing the Medicaid compliant annuity as a spend down tool in order to achieve accelerated Medicaid eligibility for their clients. We've expanded out. We've grown our staff over the years. We're over now 40 individuals on staff. And we've expanded our offerings as well. So beyond the crisis Medicaid planning with the Medicaid compliant annuity, we also offer pre-planning solutions to elder law and estate planning clients to try to get ahead of this problem. Because a lot of times there's, you know, we're dealing with the children of the parents. And there's some solutions that we can take advantage of earlier so we don't have to go down the path of doing the crisis planning later on. So we've actually acquired a long-term care insurance shop. So we have specialists on staff now who are able to structure long-term care insurance plans for your clients as well. Beyond the services and products that we offer, we also like to really lean into the education because there is a huge need to educate people in the space, especially planners. So we want to provide and be a resource for you through programming, through our online portal, which I'll talk about later on. We really want to be that place to be your go-to resource for everything related to this type of planning. So today's goals, like I said, we're going to cover the Medicaid desk reference, and this is something that we put together. It's something we've leaned on, our team leans on internally when we're putting together a case design for a client. So we'll walk through each term on the desk reference. We'll talk about, you know, why it's important, what it means, the definition, how it's utilized. We're going to identify, you know, how these key terms affect your client's Medicaid eligibility. Then finally, we'll explore some of these calculations. I did this presentation not too long ago with another group, and we took out the examples and some of the key terminology, and I found myself spending more time explaining the calculation rather than just being able to show it. So we added back some of these examples for some of these that really warrant having something that's easy to follow, because most of the stuff, again, it's not very complicated, but it just takes an understanding and really being able to show something from A to Z. So we did add back some examples. So that's what we're gonna be covering. Like I said, so what is the Medicaid desk reference? This is probably one of the most key resources that you're gonna need to have at your fingertips when you're putting a plan together for a client. I know our team, for a number of years, we had large binders filled with each state's desk reference. Now we've thankfully moved most of this to our online portal where we're able to kind of navigate them more quickly. But again, these are the roadmap to your client's eligibility. So on their face, it's just a lot of key terms and then numbers. But you know, today we'll talk about what the key terms mean and how we actually utilize the numbers contained therein. These are state specific, so your state's desk reference is going to be different than somebody else's state. So Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan and Florida all are going to have a little bit different terminology potentially, or the numbers might be different. And you'll see a lot of states might have common terms, or some of them will not contain certain terms, and we'll talk about why that is. It's really because certain states have taken a different approach to the qualification requirements. So if your state doesn't have them, I can very quickly look at a desk reference and know how the state treats certain qualification requirements. So we'll talk more about that in the presentation. So how is it used? Well, like I said, it's really that roadmap to qualification for your clients. So it really answers some of these key questions. You know, how many assets can my client keep and still achieve eligibility? Are there any income limitations on what they're able to have an income on a given month? Is the spouse eligible for an income shift? And we'll talk a little bit about that when we get to the MIMNA rules. And we always recommend, you know, keeping this close by you. The key is you always want to make sure you have the latest figures, because the figures do update pretty frequently. So we want to make sure that we have the latest figures. And these do update multiple times a year. The latest update was in January, where the CESRA, the Max MIMNA, and the Divestment Penalty Divisor were updated. And these updates really coincide with inflation and things of that nature. So there's a pretty big jump in some of these figures given the high inflationary environment. Again, they update in July in a number of states for the minimum MIMNA, the Divestment Penalty Divisor, if they didn't update in January. And then finally, in October, a number of states update the shelter standard and standard utility allowance at that point. And I'll get into what each one of these terms mean throughout the presentation, but just giving you an idea that the desk reference that you're going to be looking at today, you know, come July, you're going to have to get rid of that desk reference and most likely get the updated version. So where can you find your desk reference? I recommend, if you don't have your state's desk reference in front of you, I recommend going to our website right now. You can do so by getting an attorney access account at medicaidannuity.com/join. And here is a place where we keep all these figures. We actually have a relationship with a number of organizations where we supply their state figures. Because we have contacts with each Medicaid office, we're constantly pinging them to get the figures as soon as they're released, and then we will alert you in the system that the numbers have changed. We just did a big overhaul of the Attorney Access platform. We still have a free platform, which is great, has the desk reference available. We also have some advanced features that we added for a monthly cost, but definitely a tool that you want to explore if you're really serious in this area and you're planning frequently. We've added a number of calculators and some additional features that we really think will benefit you in your day-to-day practice. So kind of how we're going to go through each term, we're going to define the what. You know, what is the definition of this figure? In what context is it used? You know, where is this figure used? Is it state specific, or is it the same across all states? We'll talk a little bit about that. Certain states, like I said, take different approaches to how they calculate the asset and income limitations. And finally, why? You know, why is this figure important? How do we apply this figure in real life? And like I said, we'll go through some quick examples of how the figures are actually utilized. So the first section on the desk reference is the asset regulations. And the first term under the asset regulations is a divestment penalty divisor. What is a divestment penalty divisor? This is going to be the figure used to determine how long a Medicaid applicant is going to be ineligible for benefits if there's been any previous divestments leading up to the Medicaid application. Each state uses a divestment penalty divisor, and the figures are always going to be state specific. And this figure is important because it is used to calculate that penalty period. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So breaking this figure down, Medicaid, when your client goes to apply for benefits, as part of the Medicaid application, they're going to ask the question, has this applicant or their spouse made any divestments or made any gifts within the last 5-year look back period or 60 months? So as part of that Medicaid application, you're going to have the conversation with your client, and you're going to have to list out any divestments that were made within that time period. Those divestments will be totaled up, and any divestments will take that total, we'll divide in that divestment penalty divisor, which represents the average cost of nursing home care in that state, and that will give us our penalty period that we must wait out before benefits will then kick in. So, you know, whether these divestments were made not contemplating Medicaid qualification, or if they were made as part of a strategy like a single person plan where we're actually making a gift and then we are creating a penalty period. And then, so there's a couple approaches there, but this is really a term or a figure that we're gonna need to know to determine how long we must wait out before benefits will kick in. So what constitutes a gift or a divestment? Gifts occur when a Medicaid applicant or their spouse, if one exists, transferred ownership of assets to another party for either less than fair market value or no value at all. You know, the Medicaid office is going to scrutinize intra-family gifts more so than they would payments or things to a third party. So that's something we have to maybe a starting point to have those conversations with our clients is if they've made any gifts to family members within that 60-month time frame. There's a couple approaches that Medicaid could take. They could take when no compensation is received, the entire value of the asset that was transferred will be penalized. If some money was given back or maybe it was partially compensated, then there will be just the difference in value will be penalized. Gifts are going to be calculated on an aggregate basis, meaning that we're going to total up all the gifts within that 60-month look-back period. And it doesn't matter if there's a community spouse in the picture, we're going to total up the gifts made by either spouse. So we're not going to say, doesn't matter which spouse made the gift, it's going to be a total figure by both spouses. Some examples of common gifts would include if we funded an irrevocable trust, maybe for Medicaid qualification purposes in the future, that and we didn't make it that full 60-month period, that would be a gift. A transferring ownership of a vehicle or home, if we sold the vehicle to a child, if we sold a home. Giving cash to family members, so for making gifts to family members of cash at any point, those would obviously constitute a gift. So just an example of how this calculation works and just giving you an overview of the calculation itself. The first step is going to determine the gift amount within that 5-year look back period. So here, just as an illustration, we sat down with our client, we determined that they had made 4 gifts within that 60-month look back period, and those gifts totaled $60,000. So in this state, let's just say that the penalty divisor is $10,000 to keep things simple. And $10,000, again, represents the average cost of care in that particular state. So the state says for every $10,000 that you gave away, that's 1 month you could have otherwise paid for your care. Therefore, you must wait out 1 month. So here, the total penalty gift or the total gift amount of $60,000 is divided by the penalty divisor of $10,000. That leaves us with a 6-month period of ineligibility before those benefits will kick in. So there's going to be a 6-month penalty period that the client is subject to wait out prior to benefits then beginning. One note here, there's no limit on the length of the penalty period. So if your clients had made gifts maybe back way back in the past, and you know, we might want to wait out that 60 months, we might want to do the math to determine, does it make more sense to wait out the penalty period of 60 months, or do we want to file the application now? Because again, there is no limit on how long that penalty period will be. There could be some opportunity to cure the gifts prior to the Medicaid application, but that's just something we'd have to kind of weigh out with our clients. So the next term on the asset regulations is the individual resource allowance. You know, what is it? It's the amount of countable resources a Medicaid applicant can keep and still qualify for benefits. So we talk about the Medicaid applicant. This is going to be the person in the facility, the person receiving the care in most cases. So where this applies to all Medicaid applicants in all states, but some states may use a different figure. There is some variance in the figure across state lines, but generally speaking, it's either the $2,000 mark, and it can jump up. Like here, we have the example of $4,000 in the District of Columbia. Why is this important? Because any assets above this limitation must be spent down or must be put into another asset limitation in order to qualify for benefits. We'll talk a little bit more about that. So breaking this down a little further, Medicaid employs a strict asset limitation for applicants. And typically applicants, those in the facility, can only keep $2,000 in countable assets in his or her name. Well, the individual resource allowance is the same in most states. It can vary, like I said, from state to state. And here's some examples. We have Connecticut of $1,600 and Maryland with an allowance of $2,500. However, not all assets fall under this umbrella of countable assets. Medicaid takes really two approaches to assets when determining, you know, what assets the client may keep. There's exempt assets. So these are the assets that the Medicaid office is not concerned with. The client's able to maintain these. They do not go towards that limitation of typically $2,000. So those would be things like the primary residence, one vehicle, personal and household items, things found in the common home, small whole life insurance policies, which we'll talk about at the end, and also irrevocable funeral expense trusts. And we'll talk more about that as well. The assets we are concerned with are countable assets. So this would be things like checking and savings accounts, CDs and money market accounts, any deferred annuities or annuities that don't meet the strict requirements of the Deficit Reduction Act, additional real estate and second vehicles. And unfortunately, IRAs in most states are countable assets. So again, for an individual in the facility, they're only going to be allowed in most cases to keep $2,000. But what happens if both spouses are in a facility at the same time, both applying for benefits? This does not happen all too often, but it does happen frequently enough that we have to know the rules around it. And Medicaid said instead of allowing each spouse to keep $2,000 in his or her name when applying as a couple, we're going to actually lower the limit of allowable assets to $3,000 in most states. So instead of the $2,000 each, now we can keep $3,000 combined. So we can leave $2,000 with one spouse, $1,000 with the other, or $1,500 with each. So it's kind of, they're just splitting it a little bit differently. Again, this figure may vary state by state. And just note here that there's a separate resource allowance when one spouse is living in the community, and we'll talk about that resource allowance when we get to that section. But this really only applies in the situation where both spouses are in the nursing home at the same time and we're applying for benefits concurrently at the same moment. So again, it doesn't happen all too often, but it happens enough. We see it here enough where we have to understand the rule. So the next section on the desk reference is the income regulations. The income regulations, the first term that we're going to cover is the personal needs allowance. This is the amount of monthly income that the Medicaid recipient may keep for small personal expenses. So Medicaid is really designed to cover room, board, pharmacy, incidentals, everything to keep the person safe in that setting, safe and healthy, fed, things of that nature. But Medicaid does allow for a small monthly benefit to be retained by the Medicaid recipient in order to cover some of these one-off expenses. So when someone receives Medicaid benefits, their income is going to be subject to paying the nursing home bill. So everything less than deductions is going to go towards the nursing home bill as the Medicaid copay. However, like I said, Medicaid is allowing individuals receiving benefit to receive a small stipend each month in order to cover some of those extra costs not covered by Medicaid. So some of the things would be clothing, toiletries, haircuts, things of that nature. I know when I do this presentation with one of my colleagues, he calls it the Snickers and haircuts account. So basically, that's in most cases all it can really cover because it's a relatively nominal amount in most states. One note here, if the Medicaid recipient does not spend their allowance and it causes their bank account to exceed that individual resource allowance, which we said in most states is $2,000, we want to be careful of that, especially when we come up for reassessment, that they are back down below that limitation in their individual resource allowance, or it could cause some issues with continuing to receive the benefit. So that's something we want to always be conscious of, that the individual's spending that money and it's not building up in their account to any meaningful level. But again, in most states, it's a nominal amount, so recipients or applicants have no problem spending this amount each and every month. The next term on the desk reference is the income cap. The income cap threshold is used for determining whether an applicant qualifies for benefits, really without establishing what's known as a qualified income trust. We'll talk a little bit about that. If the income exceeds the cap, a special income only trust will be required to be established in order to achieve qualification. And the income cap, it sounds alarming on its face. A lot of misconception around this, but it doesn't actually mean that they can't qualify if they have income above this threshold. It just means, again, that we have to establish a qualified income trust to flow the income through. It's otherwise known as a Miller Trust. So really here, any income in excess of that cap, which is currently $2,742 in most states, must flow through this trust in order for the applicant to be Medicaid eligible. So just breaking down what a QIT is a little bit further, it's an irrevocable income-only trust, so income's gonna flow into the trust. And above that threshold, which you said is $2,742, and it's going to flow back out to cover, or it's going to flow out through allowable expenses like the personal needs allowance. If there's a shifting of income over to the community spouse, if one exists, so the monthly maintenance needs allowance. Certain Medicare deductions are allowable to come through this as well. And then finally, the Medicaid copay will go out of this account. This account, or the trust, if administered correctly, it should all the money should flow, come in and then flow out in that same month. So there really shouldn't be a balance. But if there is any funds remaining in the trust upon the death of the recipient, then this is subject to an estate recovery. But again, in most cases where it is administered correctly, there should not be any remainder in the qualified income trust. Where does this apply? About a little less than half or around half of the states require that a QIT be established, whereas the others just don't require it. The checks for the nursing home bill above and beyond that $2,700 threshold could come right from the Medicaid recipient. But these other states, we have to establish one, and it's pretty typically an easy process to set one of these up. These can be a one-page document, then we just have to go get that bank account and flow the income above that threshold, or maybe more of that income, in, or all of it in some cases, into that qualified income trust. And then it flows out back to make those payments and allowable deductions. Then if you have this term on your desk reference, this does not affect many states. I have a list of 9 states take the approach of a gross income cap. And this one is a little bit harsher, whereas the income cap, we just have to set up that qualified income trust. The QIT gross income cap, these states actually take a little bit more, I guess, restrictive approach that states that an applicant that has income above this threshold, which is a larger threshold than the QIT, that's going to almost act as a hard cap, and it's going to prevent the applicant from being able to qualify unless we're able to increase or decrease that income in some way, shape, or form. Some states have taken the approach where the figure is set, so they have an actual number attached to it, whereas others states have taken the approach of using that facility's Medicaid reimbursement rate. And I have four states that take that approach, so it's a little bit more nuanced. You have to maybe work with the facility to get that figure. It's not going to be something is easy to find, is just published on the desk reference. So something to keep in mind, but again, it does not affect many states. But if you are in one of those states, and the states with the hard income cap are Arizona, Colorado, Iowa, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and then those who take that more restrictive approach, or that where we have to figure out the Medicaid reimbursement rate, would be Connecticut, Kansas, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. So those are the states that we that affect this term, or this term is applicable to. The next section is the spousal impoverishment standards, and this section really comes into play when we have a community spouse at home and we're able to set aside income and assets in order to maintain the community spouse's lifestyle. So these are only going to come into play in that situation where we have a married couple with one spouse at home and one spouse in the facility. Community spouse resource allowance, this is the first term. And this really deals with the assets that the healthy spouse is able to maintain and still qualify the unhealthy spouse or the spouse in the institution for benefits. Yeah, this term, again, this is commonly known as the CESRA, so you might hear that term thrown around, so Community Spouse Resource Allowance, but CESRA for short. And breaking this down, in addition to that individual resource allowance that we said it was $2,000 in most cases, for the spouse in the facility, the community spouse or the healthy spouse is entitled to an asset allocation as well and still be able to qualify the institutionalized spouse for benefits. So once we leave both spouses with their allowable resource allowances, if there's any assets above that threshold, that's when a tool like the Medicaid annuity would come into play to spend down those additional assets above those limitations. So states really take two approaches to calculating the CESRA or whatever the community spouse is allowed to retain. In standard CESRA states, the states make it very easy. They say whatever the couple has, we leave the unhealthy spouse with $2,000, and then the community spouse is always going to be entitled to $148,620. So whatever they have in remaining assets, they're allowed to just keep that full $148,620. So if they had, you know, $200,000, we'd be able to protect $148,620 of that $200,000, and then just that difference of about $50,000 would have to be spent down. Other states, about a half or more of the other states, take a little bit more complex approach where we have to actually do a calculation in order to determine what the CESRA is for the community spouse and what they're allowed to keep. So we actually have to do a calculation. In the min-max states, that's what we refer to them, min-max CESRA states, the allowance is going to be dependent on a date known as the snapshot date. The snapshot date is a term of art, but it's really the date where we're looking back in time in a lot of cases to find that first day where there's 30 consecutive days of institutionalization for that spouse who's on claim. And we're going to be able to look back at the client's or the spouse's assets as of that date. So despite what they come into your office with today, we're able to look back in time to take one half of the assets as of that snapshot date. So it's something we have to look back and see that the client was in the facility. They did not transfer home within that 30 days. They could transfer from, say, a hospital to the nursing home. But as long as they don't break the chain by transferring out of the facility, that snapshot date will be established as of that first day where there's 30 consecutive days. So we're going to take the total countable assets as of the snapshot date and divide that figure in half. And so long as that figure falls in between the minimum CESRA of typically $29,724 and the maximum CESRA of $148,620, they're allowed to keep that amount as their actual CESRA. And we'll show you how this actually works with a little example here. So the first step, again, is to determine the count of assets as of the snapshot date. Here we have a couple. They have a checking account, savings account, IRA, extra vehicle. You total those all up. We have 250,000 total countable assets. So the second step here is we're going to divide those assets in half. So 250,000 divided by two, we are left with 125,000. And the third step is to determine the actual CESRA. Because that 125,000 falls in between the minimum and the maximum, that's the allowed amount. So that's going to be the actual CESRA in this case. A counterexample of that would be, you know, if the couple had 400,000 in total countable assets, you divide that by two, that's 200,000. So they'd only be allowed to keep the 148,620. The rest would have to be spent down. And the same is true for the minimum example. If they had assets less than that, we'd go through that same process. But pretty easy. You know, again, the key here is to find that snapshot date, find the asset base, divide by two. It just has to fall within that, between that minimum, that maximum, and that's the amount we're going to be able to leave the community spouse with as their community spouse resource allowance. Where does this apply? Again, most states, I think more than half, majority, half make you actually do this calculation, whereas the other states in black just allow you to have that standard figure, the maximum amount in most cases. So the next figures under the spousal impoverishment standards really deal with the income that we're allowed to, or that the community spouse is entitled to and when we're qualifying the unhealthy spouse for benefits. And this is going to be an actually a figure that's kind of a almost a lower threshold. It's not, it's going to be an income floor, which is unique, but it's going to determine and help maintain that community spouse's lifestyle in the community so they have adequate income in order to meet their needs. So breaking this down a little further, while the institutionalized spouse is subject to income limitations, which is typically the private paid cost of the nursing home bill in most states, is so long as the institutionalized spouse has income less than that, we're able to qualify them on an income, from an income standpoint for benefits. The community spouse is Medicaid actually put together an income floor. There is no cap on the amount of income that the community spouse may have. This is really key when we're putting together a community spouse plan, because we create income usually above these thresholds that we'll talk about. But Medicaid, again, in order to ensure that the community spouse is not impoverished and they have adequate income to cover their monthly expenses, this is the income floor that the community spouse is entitled to. And if they are below this income floor, then we're able to shift over income from the institutionalized spouse dollar for dollar until that allowance is met. Kind of like the community spouse resource allowance, states have taken two different approaches to determining what the MIMNA is. So in the standard MIMNA states, the community spouse is entitled just to a standard amount of $37,1550. So if the community spouse has income less than this floor, then we're able to shift over dollar for dollar, get them up to this amount from the institutionalized spouse. So pretty simple. They made life easy. Again, the community spouse can have income in above that threshold. They can have income of any amount. They're just not going to get that shifting of income from the institutionalized spouse. Other states, the majority of states, again, have taken the approach where we actually have to do a calculation in the minimum, maximum MIMNA states. We have to determine what the actual MIMNA is. And it's the actual MIMNA is going to be based on the shelter expenses that we can prove up that the community spouse is responsible for. And we're really looking for three things here. It's going to be the community spouse's monthly shelter expenses. So we're looking at expenses that are reoccurring, things like the mortgage, any HOA fees. If there's a tax bill, we divide that by 12, we get the monthly expense. Homeowners insurance, renters insurance, things of that nature. The second is going to be the shelter standard. This is a term that's on the desk reference, which we'll talk about. The third is the standard utility allowance. Again, this is part of that calculation. Again, it's on the desk reference, so we will go through what that term means. The actual amount of the community spouse will be entitled to will fall between that minimum MIMNA and a maximum MIMNA. Same thing, it's really determined about based on those excess shelter expenses. We'll talk through that calculation here momentarily. So before we get to the calculation, I just want to define what the shelter standard and the standard utility allowance are, because these are key terms that we need to know in order to conduct this calculation. So the shelter standard is the amount of monthly housing expenses the community spouse is responsible for. And this figure, the state says, you know, the average shelter expenses for community spouses like similarly situated is this, and they take one half of that figure, and that gives us the shelter standard. It's going to be used in those minimum maximum states. So if you don't have this, if you have this figure on your desk reference, that we know then we have to do that calculation. And again, it's critical to conduct the MIMNA calculation. So breaking this down a little further, in those minimum maximum MIMNA states, the allowance is calculated based on the community spouse's total shelter expenses. Of those expenses, the state is going to assume that the community spouse can cover an amount equal to the shelter standard of, in most cases, $686.63 without increasing their MIMNA. So they're saying this is the what the community spouse is, you know, responsible for on average, you know, across the state. This is what a community spouse is going to be paying, you know, if there's a two-couple household or a two-person household. And so therefore, we don't have to increase the MIMNA. But if we can show expenses above the $686.63, that's when we can get that shifting of income dollar for dollar over from the institutionalized spouse to the community spouse. The next term that we need to understand to do this calculation is a standard utility allowance. And this is going to be part of that calculation as well. And this is going to take the place of, it's a, the state Medicaid office does not want to look at everyone's utility bills, you know, cable, heat, things of that nature. They just want to take a standard figure that kind of represents the average across the state and apply this as part of the calculation. Again, it's going to be used when we're doing the MIMNA calculation. So breaking it down, again, instead of, you know, looking at month bills on a monthly basis, because those bills can vary and they can kind of be all over the board depending on the house size, things of that nature. It's just a standardized figure that we're going to use in place of the actual monthly utility bills. So breaking this down and actually walking through a MIMNA calculation, the first step is we're going to determine the monthly shelter expenses, so the total monthly shelter expenses. So here we have, in this case, we have a husband and wife. We retained a mortgage on the home of $1,100. We have real estate taxes of $150 per month. And then we've got the annual bill. We divide it by 12 to get that monthly figure. We have homeowners insurance, $85 per month. And then we're going to add in that standard utility allowance of $374 in this particular state. So that gives us total shelter expenses of $1,709 per month. The second step is to determine the excess shelter expenses. So we take the total shelter expenses of $1,709 per month, and we subtract out the shelter standard, which we said is the community spouse's responsibility of the total shelter expenses. And we're left with excess shelter expenses of $1,022.37. And we are always going to be entitled to at least the minimum MIMNA or the minimum threshold, but we're able to expand up to that, you know, full amount if we have adequate MIMNA expenses. So here we're going to add to the base MIMNA of $2,288.75 those excess shelter expenses of $1,022.37. So our actual MIMNA in this situation will be $3,311.12. So again, if the community spouse has income less than that threshold, we're able to shift over dollar for dollar to get he or she up to that minimum floor. And like I said, the majority of states make us do this calculation, and the other states just make it easy. They just give us a standardized figure. So we have to be comfortable, you know, putting this formula into place. So the last section here, we cover a few of the exempt asset limitations that we talked about earlier. The first exempt asset limitation is going to be the funeral expense trust limit. And what is the funeral expense trust? This is going to be the face amount that we're able to set aside for a burial plan for our clients in order to cover those costs in the future. So this is going to be allowable spend down that we're not going to consider, you know, as part of either a divestment or as an asset it's going to be eliminated off the asset balance sheet. It's going to apply in all states, but certain states use different limits, or some states allow you to purchase the policy for different family members or different, I guess, has different restrictions on who we could put a policy in place for. And applicants can own a funeral expense trust below the limit and still qualify for benefits. So this is important. And again, we always recommend that clients, you know, put this policy into place when they're doing the Medicaid application and they're, you know, they're doing any other planning. It's just a good way to set aside some funds, and it takes it off the amount that has to be spent down overall. So breaking this down a little further, Medicaid applicants are allowed to own a funeral expense trust so long as the face value is either at or below the limitation that is, you know, put on the desk reference. In some states, applicants can also purchase a funeral expense trust from immediate family members. So beyond the purchasing it for the person in the facility, they can purchase one for the spouse at home if one exists. And in some states, they're able to also purchase one for immediate family members, and that's all defined in the Medicaid handbook. This limit varies from state to state, but it's $15,000 in most states, so it's enough set aside that we're able to, you know, adequately cover the cost of most, you know, funeral presentations. So it's something that we definitely want to take advantage of if we can. Some states do have a limit, so the figure in the insurance may be a limit enforced by the insurance company. So the states that don't have a stated limit, insurance companies kind of put together a limit that they enforce. Certain states are going to require a letter of goods and services to accompany the trust, so we actually have to kind of list out the items that we're paying for ahead of time. So we have to couple this with the actual contract, and we have to say, here's the goods and services that we're paying for in the future. The letter of goods and services, this is going to accompany the funeral expense trust and, like I said, outlines those specific costs of the funeral expenses. So this would be things like the casket, burial plot, funeral service, other elements, things of that nature. Some states are going to require this in order for the funeral expense trust to be considered exempt. And some states are going to offer maybe an expanded limit for this funeral expense trust if we include a letter that covers these different cost elements. The next term on the exempt asset limitations is going to be the life insurance limit. Medicaid is going to allow applicants and spouses to have these small whole life insurance policies. They're allowed to keep a very small face value of about $1,500 in most states. So, you know, it's something that can be purchased. We don't see too many attorneys really taking advantage of this, just because, again, $1,500, there's many ways to spend that amount down, but it is something that can have a benefit in the future. So it's something, you know, we always recommend taking a look at, but the limitation in most states is $1,500. The final term on the Medicaid desk reference is the home equity limit. And this amount, like we said earlier, when we talked about exempt assets, countable assets, the home is typically going to be the exempt asset that a lot of people retain, especially couples. So this comes into play, or this is something that we have to kind of just take a look at. But it really signifies the amount of home equity that Medicaid applicants are limited to. It applies in all states, but the limit varies state to state based on whatever the shelter costs are in that particular state. Applicants can have equity in their home below the limit, still qualify for benefits. So it really is looking at equity, not the value of the home. So breaking this down a little bit further, the home is going to be typically the largest asset owned by Medicaid applicants. And again, although it's considered exempt, this limit is designed to prevent someone with significant equity in their home from qualifying for benefits. This limit is related to equity, not the overall home value. And it's going to vary state by state, but what we see is between $688,000 and $1,033,000. So some variance there depending on the state. Definitely some exceptions to this limit. The home equity limit does not apply when we have a community spouse living in the home or a minor disabled child who's occupying the residence. So we're not going to concern ourselves with this equity limit if we have that situation. This really only comes into play when we have a single client who's looking to retain the home in a way that they, you know, they intend to go home if they, you know, are able to in the future, And they would do so by having an affidavit that they have the intent to return home and they're able to retain it as an exempt asset, but then these equity limits would then apply. So I know we covered quite a bit of content here, but where can I learn more about these desk reference figures and some of these planning concepts? Well, good news, we actually are just releasing, we're in the pre-order phase of releasing our flagship resources, the Krauss Report. We put this out annually, really maintains a lot of this foundational information about this planning. And it takes some of these key terms that we defined today, puts them into the actual planning strategies and shows you how they're applied in a planning context. So definitely recommend pre-ordering your copy today, medicaidannuity.com/pre-order. It's free. Take advantage of that if you can. Elisa, did we have any questions that came through?
We did have a couple questions come through. All right, so the first one we'll start with. Once the institutionalized spouse has been approved for Medicaid benefits, are the assets of the community spouse required to always stay below that CESRA limit?
That's a great question. It's a pretty common question that we receive. So question is, once we get that initial qualification and we left the institutionalized spouse with his or her $2,000 individual resource allowance, and we determined what the community spouse resource allowance was, can the community spouse's resources go above that threshold that we determined as the CESRA? The answer is yes. After initial qualification, the Medicaid office is no longer going to concern themselves with the assets of the community spouse. So we're able to, if the community spouse is receiving income each and every month, and maybe a shifting of income or income from an annuity, we can allow those assets to go into savings and go above the limitations without fear of disqualifying or causing eligibility issues in the future for the institutionalized spouse. That's a great question.
Perfect. Okay, another question we had come in here regarding the MIMNA shift you talked about. Is there any opportunity for an income reassessment for the community spouse if they are ineligible at the time of application but become income eligible later?
Yeah, that's something that a lot of states, I know the attorneys take that approach. They'll try to get the income high. It might be high with the annuity structure. However, we structure the annuity for a number of months, but then after that annuity income falls off, then the income falls back below a certain threshold, we can actually go back and petition to get a MIMNA readjustment or reassessment now that the income has changed, and then we can go after that shifting of income. So that's something that your client can take advantage of. Obviously, the institutionalized spouse still has to be on benefit for this to all work out, but it is something that a lot of attorneys consider when they're putting in place a plan.
Excellent. Okay, next question we have here. If an individual is bouncing between residing in the hospital for weeks at a time and then returning home for a short period, when would the snapshot date be based on?
Again, we got to look back at all the critical dates where we had a transfer or a transition, but we're going to find those dates where the person was in the facility. So that's a hospital, certain living facilities, nursing home facilities, and we just got to look for that first day where there's 30 consecutive days of uninterrupted care. So if they bounced back home, we would just restart the clock and then look at the next date of institutionalization, because we need to have those 30 uninterrupted days or days where we did not transition home to establish that snapshot date. And in most cases, there's only going to be one snapshot date. We're not going to have multiple snapshot dates. It's going to be the first one where there's those 30 consecutive days of uninterrupted care.
Excellent. Okay. Question regarding the penalty period. So you mentioned that there is no limit on the penalty period. If a calculated penalty period exceeds 60 months, is it more beneficial for the applicant to simply wait out that 60-month look back or to apply and be assessed a 60-plus month penalty?
Yeah, again, this is something you have to take a look at when you're working with clients. Just kind of weigh out the cost benefit of, do I wait out the remainder of the penalty that would be assessed if I applied today, knowing I made a gift in the past, or am I better off to just wait out the 60 months because maybe a large gift was made, or is there a way to maybe cure what had been done in the past and reduce that penalty. So all things we want to know ahead of time before we make application, because again, with that penalty period having an unlimited duration, by putting in the Medicaid application, that would trigger that penalty period, which could exceed what was left to be waited out, you know, depending on when the gift was made. So we just really want to be conscious of that and conscious of all those gifts. So before we go to apply, we have to know, you know, that total exposure in terms of what the divestments amounts have been within that last 60 months.
Okay, and probably the last question we'll have time for here. Does the $1,500 life insurance value count against the $15,000 funeral expense trust? So I guess, can you have separate or are they combined limits?
Those are going to be separate. Those are separate types of policies. In most states, yes, that's going to be its own distinction because it's its own policy. So your client can own both of those types of contracts and still, you know, be able to qualify.
Perfect. Well, that is all the time we have for questions today. If we didn't get to your question, we will follow up with you later this week. For those who are already members, a recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your Attorney Access account. If you're not already a member of Attorney Access, our digital resource hub that gives you access to all of our latest educational content and Medicaid planning resources, head on over to medicaidannuity.com/join to get started. Thank you again, Tom, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you, everyone.